week, a peace deal that took almost 40 years to put together.
Normalization with a wealthy neighbor with whom it shares one of its longest borders would really open up a lot of opportunities economically, diplomatically for the country.
Global tariff war.
Tariffs that we're talking about, and again, reciprocal. I think that the tariffs, there are some cases where they're a little beyond reciprocal because, you know, we've been abused for a long time as a country.
Join us now on The Voice of America as we explore the issues in the news.
Hi, everyone. I'm Lori London in Washington.
And I'm Scott Walterman. Armenia and Azerbaijan have been locked in a conflict for almost 40 years.
This week, they finalized the text of a peace agreement aimed at establishing formal relations.
The United States has praised both countries for the historic peace treaty.
In a statement, U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio said, quote, "This is an opportunity for both countries to turn the page and move in line with President Trump's vision for a more peaceful world."
Joining us now to talk more about the significance of this long-awaited agreement is Ben Dubow, non-resident senior fellow with the Democratic Resilience Program at the Center for European Policy Analysis.
All right. Well, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So it's interesting because, you know, there's a lot of conflicts. There are a lot of conflicts happening in the world right now that we've been very focused on and people are hearing about. But we haven't really heard much recently until now about the situation with Armenia and Azerbaijan. And apparently, you know, as far as my understanding is, Baku and Yerevan have been locked in this conflict over Azerbaijan's breakaway region of Nagorno-Karabakh for years. I guess if we could just sort of get you to just give us a little bit of a background on what has been happening for decades between the two and why.
Yeah, definitely. In the twilight of the Soviet era, as Gorbachev implemented reforms that devolved a lot of power to the individual republics, one of the kind of the unintended consequences was a huge spike in ethnic conflict and ethnic rivalry. And this was really punctuated by a series of massive pogroms against Armenians in Azerbaijan Soviet Socialist Republic, which led to a series of escalating pogroms and violence back and forth between the two sides that Moscow really struggled to put a lid on. As that kind of continued and the dissolution of the Soviet Union continued and Armenia and Azerbaijan gained independence, a largely Armenian populated area of Azerbaijan called Nagorno-Karabakh became an area of major contention. A war was fought in the early 90s between the two, and it became somewhat of a frozen conflict for the next 20 or 30 years with occasional flare-ups over the years. In 2020, there was a major conflict between the two sides, with Azerbaijan deploying one of the most effective and wide-scale usage of drones in warfare up until that time. Azerbaijan won fairly decisively. They took over large parts of what was then a majority Armenian part of Nagorno-Karabakh in the southern half of the breakaway region. That kind of remained the stasis for a while. Russia brokered a peace. They sent in peacekeepers, and that kind of held until 2022. That's when Russia invaded Ukraine, and Ukraine's stiff resistance to Russian aggression really challenged the sense in the former Soviet states that Russia was the ultimate arbiter of power. Azerbaijan began to test Russia's resolve to maintain the peace for its allies. Armenia and Russia at that point were in a treaty alliance, the CTSO. Azerbaijan basically gave an ultimatum to Russia to evacuate their peacekeepers to see whether Russia would actually kind of, you know, show any resolve in that instance. Russia did not. They just kind of issued statements saying everybody should agree to the peace treaty. And Azerbaijan essentially kicked out the Russian peacekeepers, which, you know, augured poorly for Armenia's future and or for Nagorno-Karabakh, especially its future. This culminated the next year in 2023 in a siege on Nagorno-Karabakh that Armenia was unable to break and Russia was unwilling to really do anything about. And ultimately led to the Azerbaijani conquest of Nagorno-Karabakh, which led to the flight and expulsion of about 100,000 Armenians as a result. Since then, peace negotiations have been underway, which have resulted in the treaty that we just saw signed or agreed to the other day.
So where are they now? There, it's not a 100% done deal, right? There's still a few things that have to happen.
Yeah. So one of the big sticking points, so for the Azerbaijani side, because it's a much more centralized authority under Aliyev, they're getting most of the concessions, if not all the concessions in this agreement. It's basically set from their side. Pashinyan, the Armenian president, has agreed to a constitutional change because the Armenian constitution references Nagorno-Karabakh. That'll actually take a referendum with the Armenian electorate, and that's going to have a very hard time passing. Because even though Pashinyan in his current position can kind of make the practical case, kind of putting something that's a lot of ways a national humiliation up to the ballot is going to be a very difficult sell.
It sounds like you said, it wouldn't be a quick deal because of so many complications as far as any full-fledged peace agreement. There are a lot of, including unconditional recognition of each other's territorial integrity. I mean, what is the probability that the changes could be made, you know, in the next month or two? Is that even possible?
The next month or two, I mean, I imagine there will be some tweaks over that time. You know, for Azerbaijan, there's not much pressure. There's not much hurry on their end. You know, they're coming to this from a total position of power. They get, you know, some kind of good graces from the EU and from the West generally if they agree to it. But that's really kind of the biggest carrot for Azerbaijan's side right now. For Armenia, yeah, I mean, it is going to be Pashinyan trying really hard to sell this to the Armenian people. But Azerbaijan was willing to drop the constitutional change element of it, which maybe they will if an election is scheduled and the polling is clear what the results will be. The foreign minister of Armenia said that his interpretation of the constitution does not make any claims on Nagorno-Karabakh. So, you know, there's some potential for that part of it to shake out if Azerbaijan is willing to concede on that, but they don't necessarily have much incentive to concede on that.
So what are the benefits for the two what are the benefits for the two if they do sign?
Yeah, so for Armenia, normalization with a wealthy neighbor with whom it shares one of its longest borders would really open up a lot of opportunities economically, diplomatically for the country. You know, on its other border is Turkey, with whom it also has very frayed relations and a closed border right now. Azerbaijan and Turkey are very close, so there are kind of whispers that if this were to happen, it could later lead to normalization of relations with Turkey, which would convert Armenia's status from being very isolated right now to having strong relations, economic interactions with all its neighbors. For Azerbaijan, it's a bit more symbolic. It's, you know, the ultimate victory in a war that in a lot of ways has unified the nation since its birth in the early 90s, and really would cement Aliyev's legacy as the person who resolved this major issue in the Azeri national consciousness.
So is that your view of what led to this sudden breakthrough after all this time?
Yeah, so it really was gradual. It was early 2023 when Nagorno-Karabakh was finally, or 2024, excuse me, Nagorno-Karabakh was fully conquered by Azerbaijan. And since then, there have been hostage exchanges. There have been exchanges of a few other small villages, formal border demarcation. So there have been a lot of kind of trust building exercises over the course of the past year and a half or so, leading to this peace negotiation. But, you know, since the beginning of 2024, kind of the writing was on the wall. Armenia couldn't do anything militarily. Russia was not going to come in to rescue them. So it was going to be some negotiation. And it's kind of been this full year plus of trust building exercises and negotiations to lead to this.
Ben, thanks so much for the time.
That was Ben Dubow, non-resident senior fellow with the Democratic Resilience Program at the Center for European Policy Analysis. You're listening to Issues in the News. I'm Lori London.
And I'm Scott Walterman.
U.S. President Donald Trump Thursday threatened the European Union with 200% tariffs on wine, champagne, and other spirits produced in the 27-nation bloc after the EU levied what Trump said was, quote, a nasty 50% tariff on American distilled whiskey.
Secretary of State Marco Rubio meeting at the G7 summit in Canada, which itself has been levied with U.S. tariffs, defended the Trump administration's policy.
But ultimately, the president feels strongly, and I personally agree, that we have made some decisions when it comes to trade policies that have led to the deindustrialization of America and have left us deeply vulnerable to any sort of interruptions in global supplies and or it being used to extort us. Not to mention our inability to produce things that we need for our own economy and for our own defense. So that's what those policies are about. Every country in the world, we expect, will act in their national interest. The United States forgot that. President Trump is reminding us of that and getting us back to that. And I think it is quite possible that we could do these things and at the same time deal in a constructive way with our allies and friends and partners on all the other issues that we work together on. And that's what I expect out of the G7 in Canada.
The on-again, off-again tariffs between the United States and other countries are once again under scrutiny, with the U.S. president not budging. VOA White House correspondent Carolyn Pursuti has our story.
Tariffs and counter-tariffs with no end in sight.
No, I'm not going to bend at all.
As of right now, the U.S. places a tariff on metals imported from the European Union. The European Union puts a 50% tariff on U.S. whiskey. U.S. President Donald Trump threatens a 200% tariff on European wine, champagne, and spirits.
We've been ripped off for years, and we're not going to be ripped off anymore.
The U.S. imposes 25% tariffs on Canadian metals and an April tariff on lumber, dairy products, and cars. Canada levies, then withdraws tariffs on electricity exports, but keeps tariffs on $21 billion worth of American goods.
We don't need their cars. We don't need their energy. We don't need their lumber.
The U.S. puts a tariff on Mexican foods, but exempts certain items included under the North American Free Trade Pact, signed in President Trump's first term. A tariff on cars from Mexico is also rescinded. Mexico says it will respond on Sunday. And for China, 20% tariffs overall.
Now, there'll be a little disruption, but it won't be very long.
The unpredictability drives U.S. stocks wild. Analysts say if it continues, all governments lose. Jeffrey Schott is with the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
They think that if they protect their economy, they're going to increase the productivity and the competitiveness of industries in their own market. And actually what they're doing is putting them at a disadvantage in terms of price and access to global markets.
The U.S. argues economic pain now will yield great results later. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent.
The tariffs, we've got strategic industries we've got to have. We want to protect American worker, that a lot of these trade deals haven't been fair.
The administration is sending a signal that it's not business as usual here. It's now more exports and less imports. The next round of tariffs goes into effect April 2nd. Carolyn Pursuti, VOA News, The White House.
So let's get some insights into what appears to be a growing global tariff war and where this could be heading.
Joining us now is John Diamond, director of the Center for Tax and Budget Policy at Rice University's Baker Institute.
So thanks so much for being with us.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Let's just take a pause here and talk. Everybody's jumping in on tariffs. You got Canada, the EU, it's all reaction to the United States, China. Let's take a super big picture globally of what this is doing potentially to the world economy.
You know, the big picture is it's slowing the world economy down. I mean, basically what happens when you start renegotiating all of the trade infrastructure is that countries have to start thinking about where they want to import certain goods from, and that causes changes to supply chains and prices, and things that used to be determined and easy become difficult and uncertain.
One of the things that he says he wants to do with the tariff is reinvigorate manufacturing. And he sort of claims that tariffs from other countries killed manufacturing in this country. Now, I'm not an economist, though sometimes I play an amateur one on the radio.
That's true, he does.
But my understanding of why manufacturing moved out of this country was a number of factors, like the cost of labor in the United States versus the cost of labor in some other countries, and so on and so forth. You can bring manufacturing back this way, right? But that's not really addressing the problem of the cost of goods.
Yeah, I think I agree with how you stated it. You know, there's a lot of things that impact. There's a lot of macroeconomic factors that impact the flow of goods, that impact the labor market in the United States and in other countries. And so there's no one thing that we can blame this all on. There's no one thing, singular factor that this is why this happened. And you're right. I mean, it does depend across countries. But if you take China, that's a country with lower wages. And so they can produce a lot of goods more cheaply than we can produce them in the United States using labor in the United States, which earns relatively high wages. And so that's definitely one part of the factor. But it's not always the absolute cost. So in economics, we talk about it as the comparative advantage. And so sometimes, even though you may not have the absolute advantage, you can still trade in a good because you have a comparative advantage, and that can just be due to a large stock of labor or other natural resources that makes you competitive in trading a good relative to other countries. So there's just a lot going on there. You can never say you know, that one thing caused it. And I think the interesting point there is, so if you impose tariffs on goods in other countries, can you bring manufacturing back to the U.S. for certain goods? And the answer is maybe. depends on the good, how long it would take if the tariff, I mean, like if you're looking at producing automobiles and you impose tariffs for 3 months, well, that's not going to do much good because it would take a lot longer to build the plants and do all that. So you would have to have tariffs for a very long time. And you would have to convince automobile producers that those are going to be there forever so that they have the incentive to invest the billions of dollars that would be needed to produce those plants. And so it gets very complicated. But even in the case where you bring labor back, you know, you still are operating in a macro economy where there's only so much labor, and that labor has to be divvied across sectors and different jobs. And so if you bring the manufacturing back, yeah, you'll have more manufacturing jobs. Manufacturing producers will now be competing with, say, people in the service sector for labor. That's going to drive the cost of labor up and ultimately the cost of goods up. So at the end of the day, there's a lot of offsetting factors that one needs to consider. It's not the simple story that we're hearing from the administration that, you know, we're going to bring labor back. We're going to bring domestic manufacturing back, and that's going to make us all richer. That's just not true.
So kind of in the same lines as what you're talking about, if it means the economy of the country as a whole would improve, is it acceptable for the administration to continue a trade war, even if it may have a negative impact on, say, one specific group or one specific industry?
I mean, there are times where tariffs may be useful. I'm going to state it like that. It's hard for me to imagine. I mean, so if it's for a national security reason, or if you're responding to, let's say, another country that you think has some unfair competitive advantage, let's say they've subsidized the production of a good, and you think it's important that you maintain a presence in that industry, those would be circumstances where I would think tariffs make sense. Or if you're responding to another country's tariffs on one of your goods. But other than those reasons, you know, I'm not sure that it's going to be, I don't think it'll be an economic win.
One of the things that you hear in the discussion of this is globalization, and globalization is being portrayed on the pro-tariff side as the boogeyman, right? That, mm-hmm. you know, this global economy is bad. Can you shut that door at this point in the, you know, 2000s? I mean, hasn't that train left the station?
We are a long ways in to a more connected world market. Can you shut the door? No, you can't completely shut it. Can you backtrack along the path? Yes, you can. The question is, will it be an economic positive or an economic negative? And my view is that backtracking will lead to less wealth, will increase the price of consumption, and overall will reduce welfare. Now, remember, any Econ 101 course will teach you that the overall benefits of trade are positive, but there are always winners and losers. So the standard story is you strike up trade and consumers benefit, and the total benefits to consumers are usually larger than the losses to the producers.
That was John Diamond, director of the Center for Tax and Budget Policy at Rice University's Baker Institute.
And that's all the time we have this week. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you so much for listening.
For more news throughout the week, listen to our daily podcast, The Issue, available at voanews.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Join us next week for more Issues in the News. Until then, I'm Scott Walterman.
And I'm Lori London.